UK Wine Show, show number 26. G'day, welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 26 for the 24th of November. This week we're going to be talking to Simon Waghorn from Astrolabe. Simon's Astrolabe was the International Wine Spirit Competition trophy winner for the top Sauvignon Blanc in 2006, and his wines have proven very popular at wine tastings that we've been running around the country. This show is our 26th show, which makes us 6 months old today, so we're very proud of that achievement. We're also quite proud because we had a look on iTunes. iTunes keeps a top 10 list of the different podcasts, and we are number 2 in the food section behind Jamie Oliver and number 6 in the art section, which is absolutely fantastic. We're stoked about it. We've just done a change to our website as well. One of the things we've done is if you go to our website, there's a header of each of the podcasts now. If you click on that, that'll take you through to some more detailed show notes about the shows. So, for example, in the interview with Simon later on, we've put links into some of the wines that we've tasted in our tastings in the past, and they show the ratings of how people have rated his wines. In addition, there's background information about it. Haven't backfilled a lot of the earlier shows yet, but from last week's show going forward, we've got more detailed notes. 6 months down and looking good. Next up, we're going to have the news with Jane Scott.
Thanks, Chris. Champagne has reported a wonderful harvest in quality as well as quantity. The news is a relief to producers who need to meet a continuing growth in sales, which are up 7% on last year. The growth is led by exports, which are up 11%, while domestic sales grew by 3%. Grape picking has been unusual this year in Champagne, continuing into a third week rather than two, because grapes have matured at different times. Bollinger's marketing director, Stephen LaRue, told us this was due to diverse climatic conditions after flowering and throughout the summer. He said July was very hot, August fresh, and early September very warm, even at night, which accelerated botrytis. This meant drastic measures of sorting out, he explained, but the results are beautiful Chardonnays and promising Pinots. Meanwhile, Bollinger looks set for a booming Christmas sales on the back of its appearances in the new Bond movie, Casino Royale. And it seems UK wine drinkers are getting a taste for fine wine, according to recent sales figures. Majestic has seen sales of bottles at £20 and above soar by 33% over the past year. Commercial director Jeremy Palmer told us the growth had been solid for 2 years, with customers buying bottles for drinking now and with good clarets being particularly popular. Majestic currently has a fine wine display area in 20 stores and will be rolling this out to other stores as a result of the growing demand. Waitrose too has seen customers starting to pay more for their wine. The company now has 120 fine wines in more than 80 branches, and sales of bottles costing more than £10 have gone up 53% in the past year. Other supermarkets are also tapping into this premium potential. Sainsbury's said it's currently revamping its whole fine wine offer, while Tesco is continuing to extend its fine wine range and put it into 150 stores. And finally, the component in red wine that has been shown to protect against heart disease may offer other health benefits too. New research using mice has shown that resveratrol, which is found naturally in red wine, protects the animals from obesity and diabetes. The research was carried out at the Institute for Genetics and Cellular and Molecular Biology in France. It has given new insight into how the substance works, which is apparently by revving up the metabolism to make muscles burn more energy. In the experiments, mice were fed large doses of resveratrol along with a high-fat and high-calorie diet. It was concluded that the substance significantly reduced the animal's chances of becoming obese and of developing signs of diabetes. The mice, meanwhile, appeared to experience no adverse side effects. However, the scientists said that more research is needed, cautioning that no one could drink the amount of red wine equivalent to the doses fed to the mice. That's all in the news this week. Back to you, Chris.
Thanks for that, Jane. I suppose the interesting thing about champagne, or the Bollinger case, is that with sales of champagne increasing quite steadily year on year, But the land is actually limited. They can't actually produce any more champagne than they currently do. So you're not going to see the big discounted prices that we saw at the beginning of the millennium. Just after 2000, there was a big price drop as there was a lot of unsold champagne that cleared through. With the increasing demand, you know, I doubt whether we're going to see that. On the flip side, though, Champagne has been talking quite heavily about increasing both the amount of wine they produce per chunk of land, hectolitres per hectare, they call it, and also increasing the land that's available in Champagne, so that maybe shifting the boundaries of what is Champagne. Bit of a contentious issue, because if you can imagine, for example, you're a Champagne house that owns lots and lots of land within the Champagne region, and because that land is finite, it has a very high land value, which is one of the big drivers in the price of Champagne, is the cost of the land. If you suddenly open the doors and let more land in, that will drop the price of land in Champagne, because obviously there's more to go around. I'm not sure of the position on the big Champagne houses on that, but I imagine there's quite a lot of toing and froing going on there. Next up, let's have the interview with Simon Waghorn.
Hi, I'm here with Simon Waghorn from mixture of Astrolabe and Whitehaven. You're the winemaker for both those brands.
That's right, Chris. Yeah, I'm a winemaker of about 20-odd years experience, and I've been... the last 10 or so of those have been in Melbourne, making largely Sauvignon Blanc, but also a number of other varietals down there.
You're an owner of Whitehaven as well as part owner of Astrolabe, is that right?
Yes, at Whitehaven I'm a minority shareholder and I've been there since the very start. I'm the technical guy in charge of the winemaking and viticultural side of the business, and work with a team of winemakers and viticultural staff there. With Astrolabe, I'm a half owner and more involved with the whole business, including the marketing and the administration of that.
We've been running some of your wines in our tastings for quite a while now. We started out with your O2 Whitehaven, and we've been recording the results from our wine tastings into our database, and we've got them laid out in front of us. We'll put some links to these so that people can see them online if they want to, but it's quite interesting, the shape of the graphs, isn't it? Not many people dislike it, and a lot of people sort of rate it a pleasure to drink.
That's good for me to see a graph like that, Chris, because we really make the wine to be a pleasure to drink, and it's all about sheer hedonism. We make Sauvignon for unself-conscious pleasure, really, for the drinker. So when I put together the wines, I'm focusing primarily on capturing all that classic intensity of the Marlborough style of Sauvignon Blanc, which is built around things like currant leaf and gooseberries. And within that, though, I'm trying to make the wine soft around the edges, trademark acidity, but not a harsh experience. So it's all about sheer pleasure, intense pleasure, I hope.
Just talk a wee bit about the difference between, say, Whitehaven Sauvignon Blanc versus maybe the Astrolabe Sauvignon Blanc.
The main differences, I think, between the two wines is not so much in the wine making, it's in the source vineyards where I get the fruit from. The Whitehaven is a very large blend by comparison to the Astrolabe, and the source fruit for that comes from around about 40 different sites around the two main valleys of the Marlborough area, the Wairau and the Awatere, and it's planted in the western and the eastern and the northern, the southern and the central extremes of all those sub-localities that make up those two valleys. What that tends to mean is you get a variety of components to blend with, and when you put them all together after dropping out the components that I don't think make the grade for the Whitehaven style, what I'm left with is quite a heterogeneous sort of mixture of different versions of the Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc theme. Putting those together tends to rub off some of the corners, and you get a more complete and harmonious, well-integrated and seamless whole. And so with the Whitehaven style, we often see that year to year, the variation is very little, and the flavour profile and the consumer preferences are very even. With Astrolabe, our main fruit comes from two different vineyards. Because of only having the two vineyards, seasonally the variations can be a bit more extreme, so from one year to the other we might see slightly more profound changes. With the Whitehaven, because we've got so many subclimates throughout, they're less evident. So I think that's probably the main difference. Once I get the fruit to the winery, it's the same way of making the wine, but the nature of the fruit just tends to be different because of the multitude of choices we can put in the blend.
I noticed the Whitehaven always seems to have a black currant-y aroma to it. A lot of people quite enjoy it. I know that Sauvignon Blanc can produce blackcurrant flavours, but it doesn't taste as typical as maybe some of the other savvies that are around. And Astrolabe does have a hint of it, but it doesn't seem to have as much intensity as, say, the Whitehaven. What's really driving that?
I think that's just the way I pick the fruit. Winemaking with Sauvignon Blanc and Marlborough is primarily it's about making sure the grapes are grown on the right sites in the right way. But the next sort of single biggest factor is the winemaking getting out from the winery, getting around the vineyards during the growing season and tasting the fruit to see when the fruit is ready to harvest. Back in New Zealand, we're allowed to tinker around with things like sugar and acid. One thing we can't affect at all is flavour. The flavour has to come from the fruit we bring into the winery. So it's critical as a winemaker that you pick at the absolute right time for flavour. So all I really concern myself with pre-harvest period is making sure that I get around the vineyards daily to taste the fruit, to make sure that I'm there at the time the fruit is ready to pick and I can make the call to say, yes, these grapes have got to come to the winery right now. And with Whitehaven, I look for that currenty flavour as one of my core indicators of style. That is the Whitehaven style. It's built around currant leaf and English gooseberry. So when I start to see those flavours dominating in the vineyard, when the nettly grassiness is starting to dissipate a bit and the currenty gooseberry flavours are starting to gain ascendancy and a little bit of passion fruit's coming at the top end, that's when I say, okay, we've got to get these grapes back to the winery.
And how much window do you have for that?
Very short. It can be 3 or 4 days. So it's very important that you're sampling the fruit consistently and regularly on the way through to harvest. If you turn your back on them, you might go right through that magic window and be out the other side and the flavours might be starting to dissipate. So it's if you want to get that intense flavour, you have to be on the ball and on the spot.
What sort of changes in flavour do you get from, say, Sauvignon Blancs as they continue to ripen in the vineyard?
Initially, once the berries are starting to soften through the raisin period, you start off with quite an aggressive, grassy baciousness. It's a little phenolic at that early stage and coarse. It goes through sort of an unattractive, really green, grassy character through to a slightly more attractive, crushed nettles. And I quite like a little bit of that in my style around the margins. It's not central to our flavour profile, but it's a sort of like a subliminal addition that we like. Once you've gone through the nettles, you're starting to get into the more into the gooseberries. And some people refer to that area as sort of grapefruit as well. We get the Americans who are not familiar with the English gooseberries. When they're seeking out flavour descriptions, they start to talk about grapefruit or grapefruit pith. I see a little bit of that limey, lemony, grapefruity citrus just before the gooseberry starts to bite, and towards the end of the gooseberry phase is when I'm getting the currant leaf and the white currant flavours. And then when you go on through that, you start to get into ripe citrus and some tropical characters, including a lot of passion fruit, and sometimes even, if you leave the fruit too long, into ripe stone fruit.
So a lot of people make the New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc Marlborough style, you know, quite gooseberry. They're just picking it at that point, are they?
I think that's the case. We all do our own thing, and by and large, Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc as a category is pretty consistent, and most people recognise it when they see it. But for those of us that are working within that wine area down there, there are variations on a theme and there are subtle house differences between one winemaker and another. The more you sort of look at them, the more you realise that it's not a sort of homogenous whole. I think definitely is a winemaker's choice what he prefers in a style. I think just coming out of gooseberry and into currant is better than central gooseberry, but I do quite like the gooseberry styles of my competitors, but it's just not the style I choose to make myself. And I think really it is a winemaker's choice.
What about Hawke's Bay, for example? They seem to make a lot more tropical fruit style wines. Why don't they pick the grapes a wee bit earlier and get some of those gooseberry, blackcurranty flavours coming through?
That's a good question. I have seen some producers do some early picking decisions on Hawke's Bay Sauvignon, and they do become more like the Marlborough model. I'm not sure whether they have the same intensity of flavour. I think what may happen is you're getting greener flavour, but you haven't had the sort of hang time of the fruit on the vines, the slow ripening to accumulate the layers of flavour and the intensity of flavour. I think that's where Marlborough has the advantage with its cooler climate, because we have some of the sunniest conditions to grow fruit in New Zealand. But what we do have that Hawke's Bay might not have is the more extreme temperature differences between day and night, and the cool nights and the longer, slower ripening period. So I think the slowness of the ripening is where the intensity comes in. You can pick fruit early in a warmer climate, but you're only going to get a sort of a shadow of what's possible if you pick the fruit ripe in a cool climate.
Yeah, sure, that sounds good. What's going on in Marlborough at the moment? Sauvignon Blanc, is that still king in the region?
Yes, Sauvignon Blanc is still dominating the new plantings in our area. Plantings are going on at great pace, and we're seeing new areas off the two main valleys starting to open up. Blind River is one of the big new developments in our area, which is further south than the Arbitrary. And I suppose, without looking at any statistics at the moment, I'd imagine that about 80 to 90% of the new plantings that are going into the ground are probably Sauvignon Blanc. There is a fair bit of Pinot going in, and also Pinot Gris is of interest to a few people. Apart from that, most of the other varieties are just standing still or declining, and things like Chardonnay are not being replanted, or sometimes they're making way for Sauvignon or Pinot Noir. So we're starting to see Marlborough evolve and mature as a slightly more focused area where people understand what the advantages of the region are in terms of making wine for the world, and where to put their best efforts. And rather than try to make a bit of everything for everybody, I think you're starting to see people realise that Marlborough is a specialist area.
Pinot Noir is still quite a new grape down there, though, isn't it? You know, I think I had my first Pinot only about 4 or 5 years ago. How's that going down there? And it seems to be quite a different style as well to maybe some of the other Pinots out of New Zealand.
Yeah, Pinot Noir has had quite a major evolution in Marlborough over the last 5 years. When I arrived down in Marlborough from Gisborne in 1995, the only Pinot Noir in the ground tended to be a very inferior clone called Bac de Bel, which is suitable only really for sparkling wine, and another clonal variety called 10x5 Pinot Noir, which was a bit of a multi-purpose clone that we could use for both table wine and sparkling wine production. Shortly thereafter, we started planting clones like Clone 5, or the Pommard clone, and latterly we've been planting a lot of what we call the Dijon clones, including 777 and 667. Now, all these numbers and names mean nothing to the consumer, but for the winemaker, we're starting to see a stronger focus on planting the types of Pinot Noir that are geared to make the best red wine. Not only that, we're seeing a development of vineyard practice where the fruit is being planted at the right densities, being planted on the right sites, and it's being grown in the right way to start to all focus on making the very best Burgundian-style Pinot Noirs that we can. So there has been a major revolution and evolution in Pinot Noirs in the last 5 years, and the qualities are continuing to improve every year.
You said it was Burgundian in style, but that Marlborough always seems to be more fruit-driven than maybe some of those savoury notes that you might normally expect from Burgundy.
I think that's correct. We appreciate that we're always going to have a slightly overt primary fruit character in our wines, and that's just because of our climate and a little to do with our winemaking style. But fruit, just as in all our wines, just the natural gift that the climate and the soil has given us. So as winemakers with Pinot Noir, we expect, if we grow the grapes in the right way and pick them at the right time, we expect abundant black cherries and red cherries, a little bit of ripe strawberry, sometimes a little bit of ripe raspberry. And that's just a given. So for us, we have a very new world, a range of fruit flavours which are very bright and very pure and true. But where we're trying to take the wines, a lot of us, is into the Burgundian style. I think a lot of us in Marlborough, though, are really striving to balance that beautiful, pure, attractive, ripe fruit with winemaking complexities that make the wine something other than a big fruit bomb. What we're trying to do, in my case, is add a lot of layers of complexity in the texture and on the nose that come from the winemaking rather than the fruit itself. So to that end, we're experimenting with a lot of wild fermentation, a lot of aging on lees and barrels, and a lot of experimentation with the types of wood and the char levels in the wood we're using.
Yeah.
To try and, you know, just really to throw a whole mixture of aromas over the wine, but also to shore up the texture. For me, Pinot Noir is largely about getting the texture right. The fruit speaks for itself, and then the other part of the picture is the intrigue on the nose. That is the difficult one to nail, and the sort of the holy grail for us.
Well, thanks very much, Simon. That's been great.
Yeah, thanks, Chris.
Cheers.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Simon. Next week, we're going to be talking to another Kiwi. Being Kiwi myself, I am a bit biased, I must admit. But we're going to be talking to Michael Herrick from Mount Difficulty. Mount Difficulty from Otago, where I grew up, and they're one of the top producers of Pinot Noir in Otago. They're located in Bannockburn, which is just a wee sub-region of Otago. It's where Fountain Road is. They're right beside Fountain Road, actually, which is probably the best known Otago Pinot Noir producer down there. But these guys produce some cracking Pinot Noir, and I went and popped and saw them a couple of years ago when I was in New Zealand. But we'll have a listen to Michael. He's going to be talking a bit about Pinot Noir in Otago, and also a wee bit more about how flavours in the surrounding area can express themselves within the wine. Until then, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show was brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show was produced by Jane Scott and recorded and edited by Chris Scott. The news was read by Jane Scott and researched by Sandra Clement. The music for the UK Wine Show is Griff de Jingle 1 by Marcel de la Jatelle and Silence by Etoile Noire.